to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how ginseng can be an important element for helping you if you have dementia or memory loss or Alzheimer's, and how 15 almonds a day can really make a difference with your health. What is the evidence to support that nutrition actually beats vaccines in preventing disease? We'll share that from peer-reviewed literature. And from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, how breastfeeding is associated with better brain development and better neurocognitive outcomes. And also how inactivity is linked to mental decline. That's why it's so important to do so much with your body and your mind as you grow older. And more on health and healing. From the environment, I'm addressing the issue of Donald Trump and many others not believing in global warming. Well, millions of trees are dying across the United States. I'll tell you how many are dying, where they're dying, what they're dying from, and why this is directly related to global warming. And this is not something that can be denied by the real science. Also, a special commentary. Police killing won't stop. Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. We're also going today have a talkback segment, if time permits. And I'm going to give you the latest report from the official report of a parliamentary research that dug into the question of Libya. And they found that it was all based upon faulty intelligence. And it was lies, all lies. But it's important you hear exactly what they're saying in this report. Then we have to ask this question. Why hasn't the American Congress held a similar type of investigation to show that those who are responsible for the lies and the destruction of Libya should be held accountable of crimes against humanity? I'll give you the report. And then, very disturbing, is this emphasis upon vaccination by physicians. And I'm going to give you some information about the age of children who are receiving vaccines and how many reports there are about the adverse reactions to those vaccines. We're talking about from day-old babies to 1 year, 2 to 3 years, and 4 to 5 years. How many kids are actually, these babies are using it, toddlers, adolescents, are using antidepressants, antipsychotics, anti-anxiety drugs in the United States? It's shocking. And also, today we're going to have a guest in the second part of our program. It will be a continuation of our conversations with remarkable minds, Professor Henry Giroux. He is one of the most intuitive and intelligent people I know. We're going to talk about how the U.S. is at war with itself and why this is contributing to the growing authoritarianism in our domestic and foreign policies. So when you hear about violence, you're not told the full story. We have to pull back and look at it from more perspective, and we will today. Also from our audio file, how do you stop fascism? Well, a lot of propaganda right now is saying, vote for Hillary to stop Donald Trump. So when someone tells you that you must vote for Hillary to stop Trump, we have a response. And why do we only have two parties in these debates? Why don't we have multiple parties? Interesting, as part of U.S. foreign policy, we demand other countries involve multiple parties in their electoral process, yet we exclude that in the United States. We'll play that. Also, when a humanitarian gesture of giving $3 to a homeless person got the person in trouble. It's a short piece from a news service. Thought you'd find it interesting, what we become. And also, George Carlin brilliantly deciphers the hidden political language. And after he talks about this, then just think about how much you hear this every day. Let's begin. One of the oldest herbs known is ginseng. In one of the very first debates that I did, it was on herbs, and the person I was debating was a quackbuster. His name was Barrett's colleague, Victor Herbert, medical doctor and a lawyer, very articulate spokesperson for his cause, very knowledgeable, very bright, and I had seen him in debates, so I just decided to do some extra homework. The issue was, are these herbs like ginseng, is there any science behind them? And his position was no. All right. And the media's position was no, and the FDA, I called the FDA. The FDA's position was no. But then when I started doing my homework, I found over 5,000 studies, and I printed all of them out. And I took them onto the television, and I had this huge, bigger than a telephone book, of all peer-reviewed journals showing ginseng and how much it did. These were from good scientific journals. And so on the one hand, you have the official establishment saying there is no research whatsoever, and yet there was. And yet we believe the establishment, we believe the medical doctor, we believe the talking heads that are considered the experts. And that's why I encourage you, please do not let your opinion be guided by people from just one side. Look at everything for yourself. And so here's the latest on ginseng. This is where it was shown that it could impact Alzheimer's. It could impact memory loss in a good way. And they're not aware of what exactly is doing it in ginseng. They just know that the chemicals in ginseng are making an enormous difference when it comes to dementia. Quote, traditional medicines are commonly used in China for preventing and treating dementia. And dementia is a growing field. They used 5 separate studies in Chinese medicine that supported a biological activity relevant to Alzheimer's. And this was published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, a peer-reviewed journal. And they said that, quote, that ginseng consistently appears as an ingredient in multiple formulas for memory impairment. And they added that ginseng has boosted memory and destroyed beta amyloid plaques. That's the plaque in your brain that you don't want, that clump together in the brains and then create dementia. So 100 to 200 milligrams a day of ginseng for just good brain health. If you have dementia, I would suggest maybe 100 milligrams 3 times a day. Now then the subject of almonds. And almonds, of course, are a really healthy food, especially raw almonds. And they're nutrient dense. They have good fats in them, but they have lots of phytonutrients. And if you ever use any of the almond milk that you make yourself, it's delicious. In fact, I was just thinking about this last night. I was going to see a film, a documentary, Greg Palast's new film. And I wanted to get a snack before I went down, so I got some raw almond milk. And as I was walking down the street and drinking my raw almond milk, I recall the person who was first in my memory to ever create the almond milks. It was Roberta Addy. Roberta is a multi-talented person. She's a philosopher. She's a humanist. She specializes in esoteric sciences of healing. She's got very unique gifts of insight, but she's also a master vegan cook, and she's the one, before anyone else, who created all those milks, the almond milk, the cashew milk, the hazelnut milk, the filbert milk. She did all those. years and years ago. Just wanted to, you know, sometimes it's important that we recognize the people who actually created this. Now, today it's a big industry, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. She didn't get any of that. That's unfortunate. But when you're taking almonds, understanding that you're getting the fats that help your heart, you're also getting a particular type of fat that is the monounsaturated fat and the polyunsaturated fat. And these are the ones that help control your cholesterol and bring down the low-density lipoprotein. And that can help protect you from heart disease. Now, elevated cholesterol has been demonized as the primary cause of heart disease. It is not. So once you have an elevated cholesterol, then you start taking the statin drugs, and the statin drugs will shut down the enzyme pathway that synthesizes cholesterol. It also wipes out the highway that protects and produces coenzyme Q10, now ubiquinone, which is the way that coenzyme Q10 is used in every cell of our body, is essential for producing energy in the body. It produces energy for the heart. If you want to give your heart more energy, if you're an athlete and you're using the heart, you need energy. You need the mitochondria to be able to keep you vital. Coenzyme Q10 at 100 to 300 milligrams does that. If you have heart disease, coenzyme Q10 is crucial to protecting your heart. It also protects your brain, gives your brain energy. If college students would use 100 to 300 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 when they're cramming instead of dexedrine or Ritalin, they do a lot better for themselves. So you need this, and it also helps bring down, almonds bring down the bad HDL, the LDL cholesterol. And it doesn't take much. 10 grams of almonds a day, that's under an ounce. So just take a little handful of almonds each day. It can also help you with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, which is a pandemic in the United States, either pre-diabetic or diabetic conditions. So almonds are just one of those perfect foods. Then I was asked recently a question, and I'm going to be next Tuesday night at 8 p.m. following the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm going to, once again, after a four-year hiatus, I'm going to be going back to talk back, just me and the audience, and I'll have a way that you can email me or text me your questions as well as put them live on the air. And a person asked me about, is it possible to have nutrition build up your system so it can help prevent the need for some vaccines? And the answer is yes. Look at the New England Journal of Medicine, the report that they did on Keshan disease. Keshan disease is generally from a selenium deficiency. It's what causes it. And when you look in China, there's sections of China that has very little selenium. So they have massive selenium deficiency. That's an important mineral. And when you have that mineral deficiency, you can end up in life-threatening conditions, and including deterioration of your heart muscle. So it's been shown to occur also in New Zealand and Finland. Well, 55 micrograms, which is a very small amount of selenium, are recommended on a daily basis to treat and prevent Keshan disease. Also, vitamin C given 1 gram, that's 1,000 milligrams a day, has been found to be 100% effective in preventing mortality in children diagnosed with tetanus, age 1 to 12. That was a study reported by the Cochrane Library and the National Institutes of Health. Now, in older individuals with tetanus, age 13 to 30, vitamin C was found to reduce mortality rate by 45%. And so that's, you know, that makes more sense than the vaccines, which have been shown to be ineffective against tetanus in many cases. Then the National Institute of Health reports on a study identifying vitamin A deficiency as a risk factor for serious cases of measles. And the World Health Organization recommends administering an oral dose of 200,000 units of vitamin A to adults and 100,000 units of vitamin A to infants for 2 days only in areas where vitamin A deficiency is. Now, measles is generally a very mild childhood disease, And while the MMR vaccines, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, is linked to very serious health consequences, using vitamin A to treat and prevent very rare cases of serious measles is a much safer health protocol than dangerous mass vaccination programs. And also, and more evidence is now being shown that there is no gold standard for vaccines. So if you were to ask your dentist, a doctor, your nurse, if I take this vaccine, will you guarantee me that I will not be injured, or my child, and I will be healthy to withstand the disease for which this vaccine is being given? I'd like it in writing. You won't get one single person giving that to you. Why? Because they don't have the evidence. And I think that the more we look at the actual science of vaccination, the more we realize it's been a massive public fraud. And it's being uncovered step by step. The new movie Vax shows you the corruption inside the CDC. But I'm working on a new documentary right now, and it has a lot more information on that. And I'll be sharing that with you in the very near future. And finally, from Brigham and Women's Hospital, breastfeeding is associated with better brain development and better neurocognitive outcomes. A new study followed 180 preterm infants from birth to age 7 and found that babies who were fed more breast milk within the first 28 days of life had a larger volume of certain regions of the brain at term equivalent and had higher IQs in academic achievement and working memory and motor function. They were published in the Journal of Pediatrics. Quote, our data support current recommendations for using mother's milk to feed preterm babies during their neonatal intensive care hospitalization. This is not only important for the moms, but also for hospitals, employers, and friends and family members, so they can provide the important support system that's necessary. So breastfeeding wins out. I'm Gary Knoll. Now for our environmental segment. This is from CARE 2. This is important, and I would like for people in this audience who listen to Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Laura Ingraham or any of the people who support that there is no global warming, please share this with them. Throughout the United States, trees are dying at an astronomical and astonishing rate, more than we've ever seen in American history. And they're doing it right now. The reasons for the die-off vary from location to location in drought, disease, insects, wildfires. But the root cause of all this is climate change. And the epidemic is even threatening the oldest white oak tree in America, a 600-year-old giant in New Jersey. The effect is particularly apparent in mountain states like California, where 66 million trees have simply disappeared from the Sierra Nevada range in the last 6 years. The U.S. Forest Service blames the years-long drought in the area and the spread of pine beetles. And in Northern California, the ominously named sudden oak death is infecting hundreds of different plants, from massive redwoods to backyard oaks. And the disease is transmitted through water, so it can easily be spread by wind and rain over long distances. In fact, the spread already spans more than half the length of the state. Now, I was recently in California doing a lecture to a group of physicians, and I noticed on the long drive, it was about a almost 2-hour drive from the airport in San Francisco North, that there was massive amounts of brown trees, dying trees. And I asked the driver, how long has this been going on? And he said, oh, for about the last 3 or 4 years, but it's getting worse. Now, he happened to have lived up where he was taking me. And he said, if you drive even further north, it's even worse. He said, you can drive for miles and miles and see the predominance of trees are browning and dying that once were historically green year-round. So the presence of so many dead trees would be a tragedy anywhere, but in the mountains of the West, it's particularly dangerous because the trees provide fuel for forest fires. It's impossible for forest workers to chop down and remove millions of trees, so the majority of them are still standing. and in some cases, deaths and disease have overtaken entire mountainsides. I was just in Colorado just a couple weeks ago, and I was in the mountains of Texas the same week, and I'm seeing the same phenomena, especially in Colorado. In fact, when you're flying in to Colorado, you see what once had been abundant and healthy forest are being decimated. Why? Because of the beetle. Yes, but also you're seeing that we're losing all needle leaf evergreens in the Southwest. And we will for the next 100 years. But it's not just there. A friend of mine that I've known his whole life, because his father and I were good buddies, he lives in Hawaii. He runs the whole surfing community of Hawaii, does the magazine, television show. Nice guy. Talking about what's going on over there. Now, it's been a while since I was in Hawaii. I was over there in 2006 to do and won the national championship that qualified us for the World Games. It was shortly after, and I didn't stick around. I was only there for a day. I flew out, 11 hours, flew back. Long trip. But I went up into the mountains. It was gorgeous. It was beautiful. Overgrown with people, too many houses. But still, there are lots of places in the Hawaiian Islands that are still abundant with nature, especially the chi sea trees, C-H-I-A. But now, I just heard they're dying. Over the past 6 years, the Big Island has lost nearly 50,000 acres, to a previously unknown disease that causes rapid death over the course of just a few weeks. And because it's unlike anything scientists have ever seen before, researchers are unsure how to treat it. And while the plague is affecting only a part of Hawaiian Islands, it can spread and collapse their entire native ecosystem. And the disease is caused by a fungus which grows through the vascular system of the trees, preventing them from drawing water from the ground. And though researchers have examined other plant fungi in an attempt to trace the disease's origin, it appears to be an entirely new strain. Now, there's still no cure for the fungus. So right now, the priority is containing the spread of the disease rather than treating it. And then jump up to Seattle. Tree deaths are even hitting local inner-city parks. Pine beetles. Now, once pine beetles were confined to a small part of the country, they've spread throughout the United States, apparently beyond our forest. More than 500 trees were lost just this summer alone, just in local parks. Normally, they'd lose about 130. And while there's some controversy over whether pine beetles are destroying forests or simply culling unhealthy ones, the fact remains these tree deaths are a major warning sign. So this is a clarion moment. And it's not just the Western United States that's being affected by the epidemic. In recent years, reports of dying forests have come in from every part of America. Throughout New England, for instance, the hemlock trees have been slowly dying from invasive insect infestations, forever altering the composition of local forest. Again, climate change seems to be enabling the spread of the pest in a way ecologists have never seen before. And of course, this phenomenon isn't limited to the United States. I can show you this is playing out in the boreal forest and throughout the great forest of Russia and Finland and Sweden, everywhere. Forest on one of the Earth's most important protection areas is also being decimated. We need carbon sinks. Trees act as carbon sinks, sequestering nearly a quarter of all the carbon dioxide emissions from the air. When a tree dies, that carbon is released back into the air. So right now, we are seeing carbon sinks failing. And we're going to have global temperatures increasing proportionally to the increase in CO2 concentrations. That is about a 25% above current climate projections. That means in the very near future, many parts of the world will not be sustainable for plant life, for animal life, and ultimately for human life. So what exactly do we intend to do to help the 500 million inhabitants of that area of Africa and Southeast Asia and India that will not be able to supply food? Nothing will grow. The soil will be too hot. All seeds will not germinate. They will die. There's no place to put these people. There's no way right now to feed them. Isn't that one of the most important problems in the world, where you have at least 1.5 billion who are food insecure, and now you're going to have at least 500 million who are going to be immigrants? They'll have no place to go and no money to get there, no means to get there except by foot. And then another 1.5 billion. In addition to that, that brings up to 2 billion people who are going to be in need of help. What are we doing to examine the problem and resolve it? And yet, there are those who have large audiences, loyal audiences, who could be a part of the solution if they were willing to acknowledge the problem. They live in a world they create where global warming is not real. It is, and there are consequences. I'm Gary Nall. Now, before we take our break, let's hear from a person who has something to say about you must vote for Hillary to keep Trump from becoming elected.
Donald Trump is a hypocrite who can't be trusted with power. He claims to oppose bad trade deals, but he'd probably flip-flop and support the horrible corporatist TPP and NAFTA if it meant he'd get more power and attention. He may support medical marijuana and maybe legalization, but he's given no indication he'll stop the futile drug war overall, meaning the corruption, violence, and oppression it's caused will continue. He keeps saying police need more power and more military weapons. And then, of course, there's the fact that he's utterly reckless. Who cares if he knows the Iraq war was a mistake? He has repeatedly indicated he wants to ramp up military activity to stop ISIS, when that's what created ISIS in the first place. He's done shady business with regimes that repress human rights, women, and gays, abusing his powerful position to benefit his own interests. Can't you just see him acting like a dictator and ousting elected leaders if he were having a particularly megalomaniacal week?
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
He'd probably back violent coups just to get right-wing nutjobs like himself into power. Even right now, he's ignoring the will of the people, a majority of whom can't stand him, just so he can seize power he's craved for decades. I wouldn't put it past him to rig the vote if he could. He is bad, bad, bad for America. But what if I told you? Hillary Clinton is the one who supported NAFTA and the TPP, and she repeatedly shows her corporate loyalties. But don't for a second accuse me of being a Trump supporter, either by choice or by default. While Trump has said he supports working toward the legalization of cannabis and supports medical marijuana, just like Hillary Clinton, neither has indicated they'll put an end to the foundational policies of the failed war on drugs, meaning the police state Trump wants to expand will continue no matter who is elected. Trump and Hillary support decimating the Middle East with rampant jingoism. Though Trump has talked shamefully about taking out the families of suspected terrorists, Hillary has endorsed exactly that with her shameless support of Obama's drone program. Trump does do business with people in human rights violating countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton facilitated weapons deals to those repressive regimes. Regimes who donated millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation and are now using the weapons she gave them to kill men, women, and children in Yemen. This means a woman who claims to care about women's and LGBT rights has directly empowered regimes that brutally oppress women and LGBT individuals. Both Hillary and Donald are incompetent, yet she directly enabled the Iraq War, then admitted it was a mistake, then recklessly repeated that exact same mistake in Libya and wants to repeat it in Syria. It's also Hillary who backed a right-wing coup in Honduras to protect American corporations. Though Trump talks about doing horrible, arguably fascist things like strengthening the police with military weapons and violating people's civil rights and liberties, Hillary Clinton's violent abuses of power and ties to special interests make her a corporate fascist on all counts. And finally, both Trump and Hillary are so narcissistic and power hungry, they ignore the 58% of Americans who can't stand them. But it's Hillary who, with the help of the DNC, manipulated the political process and the media to make sure she ascends to her long-coveted throne in the White House. Do you see how easy it is to blur the policies, character traits, and recklessness of the two options your overlords have given you in 2016? Listen up, Hillary supporters, whether you genuinely like her or are just terrified of Donald Trump. If you cared enough to be even marginally informed about current events, you would know that Hillary Clinton's policies and actions have directly contributed to the conditions that gave rise to him. From the bad trade deals and violent drug war, which sparked waves of undocumented immigration, to the ongoing war on terror that inspires victims of American violence to wage terror attacks in the West, she directly helped create a society ripe for the demagoguery, Islamophobia, and authoritarianism of Trump, and his movement will only grow if she's elected. Neither of them is fit to rule, and I refuse to tolerate blind rhetoric from either side demanding that I be moral by voting for one of two immoral candidates. There are plenty of ways to change the world, like building societal infrastructure outside the confines of the government and the established order. So don't lecture me because you're too locked into the matrix to see beyond it. I guess what I'm saying is, there's the fanaticism of Donald Trump, and then there's the fanaticism of people so terrified of Donald Trump, they'll rationalize voting for a warmongering sociopathic criminal. And if you fall into one of those categories, you're the problem.
So there. This is our talk back. If I just wanted to share it with you for something to think about, but if you'd like to respond at the end of this program, I'll set time aside for that. This is from the UK Parliament. They had a bipartisan House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, and here's what they have done, and I'll quote them. They showed that the media, at least the alternative media, was right, and that the key British decision makers, after reviewing the documents and on-the-ground investigations in Africa, found that the Libyan war was based on lies, that it destroyed the country, Libya, and that it spread terrorism far and wide. Quote, the war was based upon bogus intelligence, like the Iraq war. And they even used an example of how when the French went into Libya in 1973, based upon all, you know, they're killing the citizens and found it wasn't true, they said the following, quote, the proposition that Gaddafi would have ordered the massacre of civilians in Benghazi was not supported by any available evidence. The Gaddafi regime had retaken towns from the rebels, those were the terrorists, without attacking civilians in early February 2011. Gaddafi's regime forces targeted male combatants in a civil war and did not indiscriminately attack civilians. Gaddafi's 40-year record did not include large-scale attacks on Libyan civilians. End quote. Again, on March 17, 2011, Gaddafi announced that the rebels, those are the terrorists, in Benghazi, quote, throw away your weapons exactly like your brothers in another town and did, and lay down your arms, and you will be safe. We never pursued them at all, end quote. Quote, from the report, subsequent investigation revealed that when Gaddafi's regime forces retook a particular town in February 2011, they did not attack civilians. Gaddafi also attempted to appease protesters in Benghazi with an offer of development aid before finally deploying troops. But he did not destroy those the enemy. Quote, Amnesty International investigation in June 2011 could not corroborate allegations of mass human rights violations by Gaddafi regime troops. However, this is important, please listen everyone, however, it uncovered evidence that rebels, these are the terrorists, in Benghazi made false claims and manufactured evidence. The investigation concluded that much Western media coverage has from the outset presented a very one-sided view of the logic of events, portraying the protest movement as entirely peaceful and repeatedly suggesting that the regime's security forces were unaccountably massacring unarmed demonstrators who presented no security challenge. In short, the scale of the threat to civilians was presented with unjustified certainty. U.S. intelligence officials repeatedly and reportedly described the intervention as, quote, an intelligence-light decision, meaning they didn't have the intelligence. And the Libyan government was fighting terrorists, quote. So this is what's important. This is really newsworthy. This is what Hillary Clinton should be challenged with and Obama. Quote, the Libyan government was fighting terrorists. The Libyan government was, quote, the intelligence on the extent to which extremist militant Islamic elements were involved in the anti-Gaddafi rebellion was inadequate. And then it goes on to talk about a member of the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Libyan Islamic Fighting Group were participating in the rebellion in March 2011. Secret intelligence reports from 2011, written before and during the illegal U.S.-led attack on Libya and recently obtained, says, quote, there's a close link between Al-Qaeda, jihadi organizations, and the opposition in Libya. Indeed, the Libyan rebel commander admitted at the time that his fighters had links to Al-Qaeda. Quote, the U.S. supported opposition, those are the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, which overthrew Gaddafi, quote, listen, boy, this is important, make note of this, quote, the U.S. supported opposition, which overthrew Gaddafi, was largely comprised of Al-Qaeda terrorists. Let me repeat that. This is from the official report. Quote, the U.S. supported opposition, which overthrew Libya's Gaddafi, was largely comprised of Al-Qaeda terrorists. And then there was a separate report from 2007, before all this, from West Point's Combating Terrorism Centers in the Libyan city of Benghazi was one of Al-Qaeda's main headquarters and bases for sending Al-Qaeda fighters into Iraq prior to the overthrow of Gaddafi. The Hindustan Times reported, quote, there's no question that Al-Qaeda Libyan franchise, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, is part of the opposition. And that was from Bruce Rydell, former CIA officer and a leading expert on terrorism, told the Times. Quote, instantly, Gaddafi was on the verge of invading Benghazi, 2011, 4 years after the West Point report, cited Benghazi as a hotbed of Al-Qaeda terrorists. Gaddafi claimed, rightly as it turns out, that Benghazi was an Al-Qaeda stronghold and a main source of the Libyan rebellion. But NATO plain stopped Gaddafi from protecting Benghazi from Al-Qaeda. A self-selected group of former top military officials, CIA insiders, and think tankers declared Tuesday in Washington that a seven-month review of the deadly 2012 terrorist attack has determined that it could have been prevented if the U.S. hadn't been helping to arm Al-Qaeda militias throughout Libya a year earlier. Quote, the United States switched sides in the war on terror with what we did in Libya, knowingly facilitating the provision of weapons to known Al-Qaeda militias and figures. So said Clara Lopez, member of the commission and a former CIA officer, And it goes on. I have many more pages on this, but here's the deal. And maybe this is what Julian Assange is going to share. Hillary Clinton was the architect of this through the State Department, so they knew Benghazi was controlled by Al-Qaeda. They knew that this was not peaceful demonstrations. These were all controlled by terrorists. And so we supported the terrorists because we wanted regime change. Now, if they found all that out officially in England and they excoriated Prime Minister, who then quit because of this, why can't we do the same in the United States? Now let's go over to my guest standing by from Hamilton, Ontario, Professor Henry Giroux, holds the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster's University in Ontario. He was previously the Waterbury Chair Professor at Penn State University and Director of the Forum in Education and Cultural Studies. He's a leader in the field of critical and public examination of the spectacle of the media, the body politic, and corporate education. His many books include America at War with Itself. His website is Henry A. Giroux, GIROUX.com. Nice to have you with us today, Henry.
Yeah, hi, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
The United States, in my personal opinion, is its own worst enemy, starting with the lame presidential candidates we're stuck with. And I assume you watched the debate or the Super Freak Bowl. And when it came to the question over the rise of violence in the United States, neither Trump nor Clinton could tackle the deeper systemic problems in the nation giving rise to the increased police violence and the rise in mass shootings, such as the recent ones in malls, and to the fact that our communities and lands and our water and food are more polluted with toxic substances than ever before, not even discussed. For example, Trump came out favoring stop and frisk, which is something we would expect under fascistic rule. And what is frightening is that these conditions have become the new normal, and people shouldn't expect much to change aside from more oppressive rules and actions being enacted by the government to keep the population in check and to protect the financial interests of the wealthy and corporations. This makes Trump so dangerous on the domestic front, but it also makes Clinton even more dangerous on the international front. So I'd like you to begin by focusing on the causes, the certain parties, and the prevailing ideas within our oligarchy and plutocracy, especially the apparatus of the government as we know it today, that permit this domestic war to continue and even increase and grow. The forum is yours.
Well, I think that what we're talking about is the United States has moved since the 1980s or the 1970s from a welfare state to a warfare state. I mean, war is the regulative principle that now defines almost all aspects of American society. I mean, schools are increasingly modeled after prisons. The police are paramilitarized. The society in general is militarized. Its highest ideals seem to be organized around the production of violence to solve almost every problem possible. You have an economic system that is completely broken. I mean, it's run entirely by the rich. And you have incessantly, it seems to me, a social order that is entirely defined by the market. It seems to suggest that all aspects of the social order can be, that the template for solving problems is basically a market-based value system. And I think that what we tend to underemphasize here is that you have a society that has really, it's not only broken, but it's collapsed into a kind of a new form of authoritarianism. I mean, we know who controls politics. We know who controls the commanding cultural institutions. We know that the social state has basically been eliminated, and we have the rise of the punishing state. You know, we have now a carceral state where millions of people, 2.3 million people, are in prison. Millions more are operating under the criminal justice system in an unequal way. And so you have a system of inequality in power, wealth, and income that really drives the system. And I think that when it comes to questions of terrorism, I mean, the war at home, the war abroad is now part of the war at home. And what we're not talking about is we're not talking about the way in which violence undergirds, reproduces, and reinforces a system that uses violence in order to control populations and to extract wealth from everybody that they can. And I think in that sense, we're in a new historical moment, one far more dangerous than anything that we've seen in a long time. I mean, we're not just seeing attacks on, for instance, social services or the dismantling of the welfare state. I mean, we're seeing the actual militarization of every aspect of society. I mean, when you start to criminalize, you know, every form of behavior from kids who violate dress codes and get arrested and put in cops cars to the extortion practices now being exercised that, as we saw in places like Ferguson, where the municipal courts and the police departments are fining people and imposing fines on people that literally put them in jail, or you end up looking at young kids who now are being fined for being truant and end up in debtors' prisons. I mean, so the overall picture here that I think has to be addressed is, you know, what is the glue that holds all this together? How do we begin to understand the connective tissue that basically gives rise to these kind of isolated commentaries that we're making about what's wrong with the United States, whether we're talking about sexism, racism, police violence? These things are all part of a much larger map, and if you don't understand that larger map, then you're basically in trouble. You do things like calling for police cameras, putting cameras on the police, or, you know, you paint both sides as if they're nothing more than the replica of Hitler. But those kinds of, you know, those kinds of analysis don't go very far.
Henry, I want to play you a short clip to show you how extreme the militarization of the police have become and how they're trying to extract money. Part of it is asset forfeiture.
What?
Asset forfeiture, because state of Oklahoma, they just introduced this little gadget that they can take your credit cards, all your bank cards, put it in there, and withdraw all the money out of every one of your accounts into their account. And then you have to, they're going to say that we believe that you might have gotten this money through drugs. That's what they're saying everywhere. $4 billion last year, that's $4 billion they took. I don't hear anyone talking about this is a crime against American citizens. Now, mind you, we're talking about people who have not been arrested, not been fined or cited for any crime, but their cars, their cash is stolen for police departments. That's one big issue. Let me show you how extreme it's gotten. Please listen.
Maybe you offer a little change. Maybe you avert your eyes and pretend they aren't there.
Whatever your tactic for dealing with panhandlers on the boulevards, understand they may be using a tactic on you.
We just had an audio glitch, sorry.
Maybe you offer a little change. Maybe you avert your eyes and pretend they aren't there.
Whatever your tactic for dealing with panhandlers on the boulevards, understand they may be using a tactic on you.
Rebecca Lesko on the game of cat and mouse.
Dane Rusk will think twice before handing out spare change again.
Well, the ticket's $175, and the $3 I gave to him, I'm out $178, all because I was trying to help out a homeless guy.
It happened Wednesday as Rusk was leaving the Victoria Square Mall.
As I came up to the stop sign, I stopped and I looked and I saw this homeless guy holding a sign. I instantly felt sorry for him.
That's when Rusk says he took off his seatbelt and grabbed $3 from his pocket.
I reached out. I had to undo my seatbelt and hang over and drop the change on the curb.
But this wasn't an ordinary panhandler. It was an undercover police officer. Moments after dropping the change, Rusk was pulled over by police on Victoria Avenue and issued a ticket.
I said, what do you mean? I didn't talk to any police officer. And he said, well, yeah, you gave him money. And I said, oh, the homeless guy.
Now, listen, just understand that. They're now having police go undercover as homeless people, as poor people, who have the signs. And then if you give them money in that situation, it's a $170 fine. Think about that.
Let's be clear about what this is. This is an act of lawlessness. I mean, this is the state normalizing, on one hand, lawlessness by putting people in a position where if they exercise any generosity, they're going to be basically fined for it. What's the message there? The message there is that you basically should support a culture of cruelty that feeds into a kind of systemic violence in the society in which you either look away or you become you see it as entertainment and get some pleasure from it. So I think at one level we need to understand where this comes from and what it justifies. At another level, it seems to me what is just so utterly shameful about this is that when you think about the resources that could be used to help people, to build shelters, to basically do everything we can to eliminate the conditions of extreme poverty, to provide a police force that exhibits truly a way to interact with the community to address enormous social problems. Instead, you get this absolutely fascistic tactic that alienates even more people and makes the police look like an invading force that basically wants to punish both the poor and everybody who attempts to deal with social problems. So I think the message is pretty clear, right? I mean, this isn't just about money. This is also about legitimating a culture of fear that keeps people away from addressing any form of social problem and also makes it very fearful about exercising any kind of dissent. This is the tactics of a Gestapo. I mean, this is an occupying army. And I'm certainly not going to suggest that all police do this, but I think I forgot where this took place. I forget the state. But it seems to me that it's certainly a signpost of what's to come in an authoritarian society in which lawlessness not only becomes legitimized, but actually becomes normalized.
Also, Henry, virtually every single one of the peace groups or anti-war groups, all the different environmental groups, have been infiltrated, according to WikiLeaks documents, by the Homeland Security, the FBI, and agent provocateurs are planted. And then when they cause dissent or they cause problems or they get them to do something that they then can be arrested for, the public does not know the truth. And so
why is that new? I mean, do you think that's new news? I mean, think about COINTELPRO. I mean, think about what happened in the 1970s when actually the Black Panthers were not only infiltrated, they were killed. I mean, so it seems to me, you know, if we resurrect any sense of historical memory or public memory, then this sort of thing doesn't stand out as something that's either eccentric, odd, or just shocking. It stands out as part of an historical legacy that really needs to be examined in order to come to grips with the ways in which the police are being transformed and whose interests they actually serve. I mean, I you know, look, you know, we live in a society where people run away from privacy. They can't exit the door fast enough. I mean, the public realm is not only collapsed into the realm of the private, but the public realm becomes a place simply to post the private, to post everything about your life. So I think the larger issue here is not only should the FBI, the NSA, and whatever groups are doing this be called into question, but what kind of culture supports this? I mean, do we look at selfie culture? Do we look at the privatization of everything? Do we look at the rule of neoliberalism? Do we look at a country that elevates self-interest to the highest ideal? Do we look at a larger culture of cruelty? How do we understand this outside of the shock of the specific incident?
Would you take the Flint water crisis as an example to show how all these seemingly separate issues of racism and racial intolerance and lack of equality and police brutality and militarization of police and private interest and plutocratic political motives are in fact interrelated and therefore revealing a very complex systemic problem?
I think that's a terrific question. I think that Flint is not simply about lead poisoning. It's about an act of domestic terrorism and the politics of disposability. I mean, it's about a system so cruel, so indifferent to human needs, that it's willing to sacrifice the lives of thousands of children in order to save money and to put coffers into the hands of the financial, political, and corporate elite. I mean, as you well know, there's an entire chapter in one of my books in America at War with Itself on Flint, and I think that Flint was shocking to me because what people don't realize is not only did they know that the water was polluted, but basically they refused to, long before the actual act of not putting in the chemicals necessary to prevent the pipes from rusting, they had mocked Flint. The Snyder administration had mocked Flint because they were mostly black and poor and voted Democratic. And there were memos indicating that they were not worth, you understand that word, worth, they were excess. They were not worth allocating funds to because, you know, they didn't basically support the Republican machine. And then when you look at the way in which certain corporate interests, the auto plant in Flint, I mean, they knew the water was polluted long before it was announced because it was corrupting the various pipes and metals that they were working with, and they got clean water, which says something about the financial interests at work in that town, which seem to be far more important than the needs of the community in general. Everything comes together in Flint. Flint is about the attack on public goods. It's about the systemic racism. It's about environmental racism. It's about a system driven entirely by money. It's about the power of corporations. And basically, it's not simply one case. It's symptomatic. I mean, after Flint, we discovered that lead poisoning is going on all over the country. Infrastructure is being ignored. Corporate taxes are being lowered. Corporations now float. They have no relationship to nation states. The social contract is dead. I mean, it's a system that has become so ruthless in its disregard for human life that it sacrifices and eats its own children.
Henry, my final question would deal with something that both of us growing up in the 60s understood, and the terrorizing of self. It's a psychological term because I feel it's very much related to what you're discussing. Could you just finalize your thoughts today about this notion of terrorizing the self and lay out the certain dynamics that can addict a society to violence? And we can certainly see this rise in many forms of violence now.
I think that one of the things that we're seeing in which the self is under assault, and I would rephrase that as saying the way in which agency is under assault, the very notion of the possibility to be a critical agent in a society. I mean, one of the things that's happening is that it's being depoliticized. Agency is being depoliticized, if not erased. And what I mean by that is that we're being told that the only obligation of citizenship, for instance, is consumerism. We're told that the only thing that we should care about are our own self-interest. We're told that people who basically are in trouble actually are in trouble because they have poor character. We're told that immigrants, Muslims, young people don't deserve to have a future that matters because they're excess. They don't matter. And because they would demand long-term rather than short-term investments. We see a public school system that's been privatized and in which, what I would call metricized, meaning that It's a system that basically works to kill the imagination by teaching to this test and absorbing and making a cult out of something called metrics. So you put all these things together, and you have the collapse of the public into the private. And when that happens, it's impossible for people to translate private troubles into larger social issues. They have no sense of systemic causes, and so they begin to blame themselves, and they begin to hate others. And I think that the only way I can sum that up is to say that's a form of spiritual and social and ethical death.
Okay. Henry, as always, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us.
You bet.
I appreciate it. Professor Henry Giroux, that's his website is Henry A. Giroux, GIROUX.com. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.